Bob Dylan there. On this day in 1985, We Are the World by a supergroup USA for Africa topped number one in the US charts. Harry Belafonte helped organise the recording of this benefit record after the success of Band-Aid. It was Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie with a stellar cast of 46 singers that included Diana Ross, Willie Nelson, Bruce Springsteen, Billy Joel, Cyndi Lauper, Bob Dylan, Michael Jackson, so many more. In March of last year, Lionel Richie suggested that a remake should be made for COVID-19. It received mixed reviews. Stephen Holden of the New York Times praised the phrase, "There's a choice we're making, we're saving our own lives." But American journalist Graham Marcus felt the song sounded like a Pepsi jingle, adding, "There's a choice we're making" conflates with Pepsi's trademark, "The Choice of a New Generation." Well, man, it does sound like a Pepsi jingle now, doesn't it, Ben?
I mean, really? The cola wars did get pretty ferocious in the 80s.
You know, we're some only good just people
we're
lost.
Only just yeah, yeah. We're only just learning about all of the money that Coca-Cola paid to be placed in movie scenes and things like that. So, who knows? I mean, I was going to say we won't see its like again, but of course we did see Gal Gadot's Zoom version of Imagine with all the celebrities during lockdown last year.
Recall this epic moment in the musical world, Moata, We Are the World.
Oh, when that started playing. Through my headphones, I'm sitting here alone in the studio, and I just started swaying from side to side with my arms up in the air. So had yeah, a little bit.
That's what I wanted to happen. There's a person getting the joy in all day there, hands in the air, maybe with a candle or something like that. But yes, having said that, it does sound like a Pepsi jingle, doesn't it? Anyway, that on this day in 85, We Are the World topped number one. A bit of cynicism actually coming through on the climate strike. I'm a school teacher, says Stephen, and I've talked to students about the climate strike. The problem is most that I talked to were in favour of others taking action, i.e. the government, but they weren't prepared to do anything personally, such as walking to school, not replacing their phones as quickly, and other small things, and then voting when they're old enough. So I see this, says Stephen, a school teacher, as another talk fest. So I'd be very interested in your responses. Comment, Ben?
One line that is I have seen amongst not just young activist circles, but activist circles, as they circulate that infographic and say, you know, 80 companies are responsible for 90% of the world's pollution. And they say we need structural or systemic change rather than individual change, which in a way is true. You know, you won't stop climate change by everybody just remembering to take out their recycling and sorting their plastics. But at the same time, you know, large corporations don't just create carbon by burning money in the backyard. They create carbon emissions by selling us petrol for our cars, or by creating packaging for goods, or by shipping things from overseas that we want. So individual action is definitely part of that. At the same time, I think, you know, there are limits to what teenagers can do. But right. You know, certainly they need to reflect on that.
23 to 5, an employment lawyer says a new government agency could be the answer to New Zealand's terrible workplace bullying. It's been reported that as many as 1 in 5 workers are affected by bullying each year, and our rates of bullying and harassment are higher than in other comparative countries. The Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment is doing a review into the extent of the problem. Employment lawyer Susan Hornsby-Gallick says one way to address the issue could be to set up a new agency solely to deal with it. Susan is with us now. Kia ora, Susan.
Hi there, Wallace. How are you doing?
Good. Great to have you on. Before we discuss this idea of a new agency, interesting idea. How bad is bullying in our workplaces?
I think it's probably worse than people think or see. I mean, we talk about 1 in 5 being bullied, but the other ones who have actually reported it or have said something. So I think it is endemic. And I think the real problem is not that we don't understand what bullying looks like. There's been a lot of work done over the last 5 years by MBIE, and educating people around that. I think the problem is that people are terrified about coming forward and making complaints. And if you put that into context, most bullying occurs between an employee and their manager. And right. Who are you going to complain to? Obviously not the manager. And even complaining to HR or another manager is concerning.
Yeah, well, I've got a few thoughts to say on this, but let's jump in with our panellists first. Mawata, what are your thoughts, your questions?
I guess I'm surprised, although am I surprised to hear that statistically we're not doing very well compared to other countries, right. Because I've certainly seen workplace bullying in my working life and have been subject to it as well. Mm. And although I think that my experience is that there is a greater awareness of it now. So, okay. I'm just thinking of one time when I was bullied in the workplace. I didn't actually know that that's what was happening. And it was only years later when we were talking about workplace bullying because, you get educated about these things, they put on courses and stuff, and you go, oh, that's what that was. So I guess it's great that's happening. But, yeah, I think I think there's a reluctance to talk to anybody about it. Like, if you've got human resources, I mean, I'm not a resource.
Yeah.
I don't know. From just starting from what it's called doesn't make you feel great. Mm. So, yeah.
Well, let's jump into that idea, Susan, this notion of an actually dedicated government agency to specifically deal with it. Do we not have the mechanisms now to deal with it? You have an independent commission come in who does a resolution, dispute resolution. I mean, that's happening now, isn't it?
Look, to some extent, there are institutions, significantly the mediation service provided by MB, but that's inherently adversarial. You go along, you state your case, the employer responds, and most of the time, actually, those processes result in an employee leaving rather than relationships being restored. I think it's too legal and it's too adversarial. And it's also the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. Right. What I'd like to see is a place, now whether this is a government agency or whatever, a place where employees can go and get independent and objective support in working through relationship problems, possibly on a confidential basis, so their employer doesn't even need to be brought into it unless they want them to, is the first thing. And then the second thing that this agency could do is workplace investigations, because anyone who has gone through an investigation is likely to tell you that they're not satisfied with the outcome. Either the employer does it with an intention of concluding or finding a conclusion that supports a predetermined outcome, or it might be briefed out to external people and cost heaps and take forever. So, those outcomes are not good either.
Ben, fair idea?
I'm always a bit leery of any question where the answer is create a new government department. Because we can set them up with all the mission statements that we like. For instance, the Human Rights Commission exists to stop discrimination on, the basis of and that kind of thing. And there was an investigation into their culture which found lots of sexual harassment and bullying. So my sort of recommendation to anyone out there who's worried about workplace bullying is probably join a union. They can provide you with the sorts of advice and independent sounding board that you need and can elevate things to management and are experienced in, dealing with employers,
Susan?
In a way that's not necessarily adversarial.
Look, I think that unions do a lot of good in a lot of situations, but the reality is that about 15% of New Zealanders are members of unions, so for whatever reason, they don't necessarily have that confidence. And also, I have seen situations where that escalates the situation as opposed to de-escalates it. So, yes, it's definitely an option, but I think we need to do better, and there needs to be something which is independent and truly objective,
right,
where employees can go and get the support that they need.
Do you think one of the issues is actually greater education in terms of what Moata was talking about, you know, not recognising when she was bullied. You know, I think we all sort of have an idea of what it feels like to be bullied, maybe, but sometimes it is quite hard to describe the behaviours. You know, a lot of the time, you know, we're not talking about managers sort of pushing nerdy employees against lockers and pulling down their pants or anything. You know, it's more sort of, it's often a lot more sort of psychological and kind of water torture kind of, isn't it?
Look, absolutely. Now, MB has already put together some great resources around that. So on its website, there are some really good resources defining what constitutes bullying and what doesn't. So that's a good first step. The next step is to work out how do we provide better support and possibly institutions to enable bullying complaints actually to be effectively dealt with.
Susan, got a bit of response on this, so appreciate you bringing this to light on the program. Thank you. That is employment lawyer Susan Hornsby-Gallick. One here, yes, I agree. When you're in a workplace bullying situation, it's very hard to step back and realise what's happening. I was in that situation, plus a number of others in an education setting. We even got the union involved, but they were hamstrung, and it did escalate the situation. So many teachers left because of the awful principal, is this person's text. Thank you for texting us on this issue. 2101 is our number. Well, completely different note. Young woman skating at a Gisborne skate park Young women skating at a Gisborne skate park say they're sick of insults being hurled by school-aged boys. An article in the Gisborne Herald say the girls are copping slights such as girls can't skate and have been called posers. Sophie Hills is a 21-year-old skater who uses the park and says comments like that are being aimed at 10-year-old girls and might be putting them off the sport, and says more needs to be done to make the park safe for everyone before it gets a $2.5 million upgrade. Sophie is one of the organisers of Shirley Skate, a group that's been set up to encourage more girls to skate more. Sophie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you on the show. What's it like down there when you're skating? What have you heard being said?
A lot of swearing, actually, which is very off-putting. Insults like, you know, you look bisexual, which shouldn't be an insult. Saying like body shaming and shaming for like the way we dress, the way we skate, like pretty much everything.
How long have you been skating at the skate park?
So I've been skating there for about 2 to 3 years now.
So it must be really frustrating in 2021 to be hearing rubbish like girls can't skate and those sorts of slights, Sophie.
Yeah. Super frustrating, especially since skating is becoming a lot more popular than girls as well.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, let's jump in. We've got a panel here, so if they might like to ask some questions. Moata, what do you think?
Yeah, it kind of just resonates with me a lot because it's just part of the larger being female in public thing. It makes me really sad that the younger generation isn't necessarily improving any. Good on you, Sophie. I would say, you know, you just can't stop anybody. If you love doing something, then, you know, the negativity of other people you just need to, like, not. And I'm sure you know this, but I'm getting a little bit upset and annoyed about it, to be honest.
Sophie?
It's very frustrating.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, it's super off-putting when you're just trying to do your own thing, run your own business, and then just some kid just wants to butt in and just turn their opinion about how you do your thing. It's not very nice.
Yeah. So tell us about Shirley Skate. This is the group you've helped organise. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So me and my sister and our friends, Morgan and Georgia, well, my sister's Tessa, we started this girls skate group because we wanted to learn how to skate, but we didn't know anyone that actually did skate. Besides Morgan. And so we just kind of like all skated together, really intimidating going to the skate park at first. But then once we were in a group, it was a lot more, and we felt a lot more safe and more comfortable. So then we just kept finding more and more girls would just show up at the skate park, would walk over to them, go, hey, you want to skate with us? They'd say yes. And the group just kept growing and growing. And then we decided to make it like a legit thing. And cool. Yeah, ran our first comp at the start of the year, which was really cool.
Ben.
Yeah, that's extremely cool. And you see this everywhere in subcultures. Mm-hmm. You know, we're finally far enough advanced that, you know, it's not like the 60s or 70s where people are surprised that women are in the workforce, you know, or in offices, say. But in subcultures, there's still a big problem with this. You see it in, you know, music and, you know, the indie and alternative scenes. You see it in, you know, literature, writing, basically all the sorts of places that kind of nerdy guys used to go to get status, you know, within a subculture kind of hierarchy, they are now really protective of against, you know, girls, you know, quote unquote. You know, this sort of idea that of no, well, you know, if you're a rock girl, that means you're a groupie. If you're a rock guy, that means you're a guitar player. Mm. You know, the proper place for girls is watching me skate. You know, so actually, this is these dudes feeling threatened.
Well, it's interesting to say this because we've just got a text right here. It says, skating and surfing are sports that have always been misogynistic. Surfers and skaters don't like to share the waves or the ramps. Women are seen as easy targets. Sophie, all the very best for Shirley Skate. And do you have a Facebook site if people want to join?
We have a Facebook, it's just Shirley Skate, and Instagram is just Shirley Skate as well, Shirley Skate.
Good on you, thank you very much for joining us. That is Sophie Hills there. And by the way, just if you are in the area, Gisborne area, that community skate park on Grey Street, the supervised hours are 3:30 to 5:30pm weekdays, and from midday to 5pm weekends during the winter, and 1 to 6pm in the summer. 10 to 5, the panel, RNZ National, Mwatata Tamaira and Ben Thomas with me this afternoon. Now, on the back of our little Lego chat yesterday, we delved into what was known as the New Zealand Lego, West Coast made. We had an email reminding us that there was, in fact, a New Zealand Lego of sorts and that it was very popular. In fact, it was exported, no less, to the United States. And we got a response, did we what? So we thought we'd get on Michael Smythe, the author of New Zealand by Design, A History of New Zealand Product Design. Michael, kia ora.
Kia ora.
Tell us about Toro. It was Lego-like nuts and bolts construction, is that right?
Yes, well, there was imitation Meccano and imitation Lego, although what's quite interesting is the first Lego patent was 1958, and that was a square block, and they introduced their ratio 2:1, the rectangular blocks, in 1969. But according to an article I've just dug up today, because you just set me off on this down this rabbit hole. Thank you very much. there's in the footprints collection of the Auckland Libraries, there's an article from 1968 from the South Auckland Courier, which talks about the it's got a photograph of a make-believe robot outside a store in Papatoetae promoting Toro Toys, which is apparently a new plastic pieces that can be assembled to various designs and constructions, very like the Meccano sets. Oh, so that's only talking about Meccano. And it says the inventor was former All Black Mr. Kevin Meets.
What?
Now, I thought that Kevin Meets came into the picture later on, but it seems that he was the originator of at least the Meccano type.
I've got to jump in here, Michael, because I can see with Ben's face, he's chomping at the bit because he looks like a bit of a Toro fan. Is that I right, Ben?
Look, I don't remember Toro at all. I don't think, but I just love it. It's just New Zealand used to be such a weird place, eh? You know, what we really need is a domestic Lego industry on the West Coast. we need children's building blocks self-sufficiency in the Cold War environment.
Well, apparently it was just so popular, the Westport factory was working 24 hours a day to meet the US demand. Mwata. Toro.
Yeah. Well, that was because they did get a lot of, Kevin Meads was an All Black in 1952, but he also graduated that year with a Bachelor of Science from the University of Canterbury. So, and he represented Canterbury in rugby, but he was
a true Renaissance man.
Yeah, but he was born in Greymouth.
Right.
And he was a great mate of Norman Kirk. And so when Norman Kirk and Bill Rowling decided they needed to get some regional development going, Kevin Meads decided to set up Mattai Industries.
Gosh, you're making it political now, Michael. I'm going to ask...
Well, there's four different factories there, metal, timber and plastic. So that's... I'm not exactly sure when the building blocks came in, but presumably then they were made in Westport.
Well, I'm going to ask Moana to jump in with a question. Do you recall Toro? The great. You do?
I do. Yeah. I don't think that we had any, but I definitely remember playing with it. So maybe it was a friend's or a family member that had it. But I definitely remember the feeling of the plastic, as opposed to what a Lego brick feels like. Is quite comparatively
brittle. That's right. It was a bit.
But the Toro brick was just a little bit softer.
You've got it.
And as the parent of a child that owns a great deal of Lego, I'm sure it would have still hurt a bit to stand on it and bare feet. But I wonder if it would have just not been quite the searing level of pain that you get from a Lego brick.
Michael, I'm so sorry. We've got to stop the Toro history right there because we're a bit short of time. But we hope to have you back on again about another aspect of great New Zealand design. Yes, indeed, Norm Kirk opened the factory, eh? And one government-appointed director was one Rob Muldoon. So it's the story that gets quite political.
Look, the one thing that we know for certain is that New Zealand First would still be in Parliament if Shane Jones had refired up the Toro factory in Whangarei, created a special limited edition Lord of the Rings Toro set.
Except that the coasters would have revolted because you can't take something away from coasters that is their product.
Listen
There's no
this.
Way they'd let it be manufactured in Whangarei. I know, my mum's from the coast.
This is gold political advice from both of you. When's the election? Anyway, the Southland Piping Champs took place in Invercargill last Sunday, and Queenstown bagpiper Jack Stobart took home a haul of trophies, winning across two grades. This out of a field of more than 35 pipers. We thought we'd get Jack on because we love a good bagpipe. Jack, kia ora, welcome to the panel.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you win the trophies for?
It was a variety of stuff. There's all sorts of different events in the different grades, and I won overall in the two grades, which was great, surprising, but great. I won best dressed as well, which is quite a
Congrats.
Thing. I've never won that before.
What drew you to the bagpipes?
I started playing when I was very young. I started playing when I was about 13 or 14. And it's just something I picked up in school. I can't tell you why. I just did, and I really enjoyed it. And it became sort of like a family all through high school. And I played all the way until I was about 18, and then I stopped. And then only a couple of years ago, I picked it up again. And it's something quite special, and it's sort of taken me all over the world, which is quite nice. So everywhere you go, there's pipe bands in different parts of the world. It's like if you don't know anyone there, it's always a great community to get involved in.
Moana, who knew bagpipes are a great way to meet people and travel?
It's a unique, I suppose, you get a unique connection with people that you normally wouldn't.
I guess you can track them down.
Yeah, exactly.
You see, low blow from a bagpipe hater.
I have a question.
Yes.
Do you think that you have like a greater lung capacity than a normal human? Does that...
You can definitely build up your lung capacity. You do. If I don't play the bagpipes in, if I don't play my actual bagpipes in 2 weeks, I'll really struggle when I start again. You have to build it, build up stamina.
Right. Because I've had asthma and it's heading into winter. I'm like, maybe I just need to take out the bagpipes.
Maybe you should.
Yeah, maybe.
You like to start.
Ben?
I've got nothing. I would suggest wait till summer. Just don't take any risks. Safety first before you.
What I'd like to know is how hard are bagpipes? Because they sound very hard. I'm a big fan personally. I lived in Dunedin for many years. Love the sound. How hard are they?
It's very difficult for me to answer that, I suppose, because I learned when I was quite young. But there's a lot going on that people don't realise. You know, you have to be able to blow the pipes to a consistent pitch all the time without thinking about it. I mean, you obviously,
Jack, we've got to leave it there. We're coming into news, but I really appreciate your time, and a big thank you to Ben Thomas and Moata Tamata. You've both been wonderful. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it. I'm Wallace Chapman, back Monday 3:45. Till then, bye.